program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. This is Felicia King, and you're listening to Breakfast Bites. And the topics that I have for you today have to do with technology, security, privacy, and constitutional rights, as well as avoiding scams. So let's start with the scam stuff. I've had it reported to me by no less than three people that I personally know in the area that they have received phone calls at odd times from people with Indian or Pakistani accents that are telling them that they're calling from Microsoft or some other supposed technology company and claiming that, oh, your computer has viruses on it. Your computer is sending spam right now. I can connect to your computer and help you repair that. Well, obviously, that is bad doo-doo. In fact, one of the individuals that reported their particular case to me said that their computer was actually off at the time that they received the phone call, and this person on the phone was arguing that the computer was that very moment sending out spam, and that at that very moment it was compromised. So please do not fall prey to these sorts of horrible scams. The only humans on this planet that Microsoft will call directly is partners or people that have an already established partner support or some sort of a support contract with. And when Microsoft calls you, you know who those people are. And you know why they're calling you. They don't just call you out of the blue, and Microsoft would never call you and just say, oh, your computer, it is spamming us. No, it doesn't work that way. So if you get any sort of crazy, ridiculous phone calls like that, just either hang up the phone on them or tell them to go pound sand or entertain yourself with proving, you know, with messing with them or whatever you need to do, but just don't give them access to your computer. That would be horrifically bad. Okay, and obviously, you could email me and let me know that the thing has happened to you so that I can get kind of a sense about how widespread this is. But I suspect that since I've already heard about it from three people, that this is a reasonably widespread problem. Okay, let's get on to Verizon's undeletable supercookie. This is a gigantic brouhaha going on right now. And that is because there's this supercookie that Verizon is injecting into the data stream if you utilize their data channel for web browsing. Now, a lot of this goes back to this concept that virtually everyone who is a freedom-loving person in the United States just wants ISPs to leave the traffic alone, meaning that if you want to have security and you want to have content filtering, then you're going to do that on your own. The problem is when we start having internet service providers or the government or, you know, anyone else who is supposed to be, you know, nonpartisan and unbiased and these sorts of things, they're supposed to be agnostic. When they start doing filtration of some sort or tampering with the traffic on the internet, generally, bad things happen, and usually those bad things have to do with destroying your privacy and your security. It's no different than how the FBI wants every technology manufacturer and every software manufacturer to install, to intentionally weaken their products to install back doors in there to make it easy for the FBI to get in. The problem with that is that the FBI and the Alphabet Soup agencies through that are really dramatically weakening the security and privacy of all of these systems for people. And when that is done, now it's so much easier for foreign state hackers and foreign gangster hackers to be able to get into systems. So it's actually really in everybody's best interest, because you're going to have less cybercrime, less fraud, less broken systems, if there was strictly an adherence to the CSC5 SANS guidelines for cybersecurity controls, which advocates the highest level of security throughout every thought process and piece of behavior out there. So law enforcement, you know, it's just, as far as I'm concerned, they're full of bullplop with their argumentation about, like, oh, well, we're not going to be able to do our jobs unless you have no security and no privacy. That's just bullplop. They did their jobs effectively long time before there were computers. So anyways, Verizon is injecting these undeletable super cookies into the web traffic. If you are browsing the internet on a Verizon connected mobile device. And so the problem with this is that you can't delete it. You can't opt out of it. And then Verizon, being the turds that they are, have decided to make money off of this. So they are injecting this super cookie into your traffic without your consent. The purpose of it is to track all of your activity, and then they sell that to advertisers who then want to know what the rest of your activity is, and they are literally paying Verizon. So wait, you thought you were paying Verizon for agnostic internet access, didn't you? Yeah, I mean, because they're not giving away that service for free, right? I mean, one would accept that if you want a free Gmail account, there's going to be some advertisements there, or a free Yahoo account. But when you pay for a service, you should not be subjected to this kind of garbage. But that's exactly what Verizon is doing. And so, if you're a Verizon customer, I highly suggest that you call up their customer service line and say, this is bullplop, and I'm really tired of it. Now, you'll find a link to the article on the WGTD site, as well as qualityplusconsulting.com, when this podcast is published. And you will be able to refer to this article if you wish for more explicit detail. The other interesting thing is that just yesterday, AT&T popped off and said, hey, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that nasty thing that Verizon's doing. They said, you know, we pilot tested this, and there's been such a backlash against this tracking super cookie that we're not going to do that. So at this point in time, AT&T is at least taking a smarter approach. Now, let's move on to this topic of internet service providers specifically removing customers' email encryption. Now, this is enormous. I mean, I can't even begin to express to you how enormous this is. If you have anything to do with medical insurance, if you have medical insurance, you have dental insurance, you have vision insurance, you have anything to do with the medical industry, if you have anything to do with the banking industry, or you have a banking website that you interact with that sends secure email, I mean, good grief, this is basically everybody. What many ISPs are now doing is they are stripping Start TLS communications from the traffic on their network. This is horrifically bad. Utterly, shockingly, horrifically bad. So imagine you happen to be an organization that requires HIPAA communications, and you've done something like subscribed to Office 365, so you're now using a HIPAA-compliant email system. You are utilizing encryption, automatic encryption based upon DLP rules, which is data loss prevention rules for HIPAA-related things. But you happen to have an on-premise environment as well. Like, let's say you have copy machines and such, and you want it such that when you scan something with the copy machine and then it goes to an internal SMTP relay server, that from there it is encrypted in transit to your hosted, your Office 365 hosted email solution. Furthermore, your business partners that also have their own email system, you want emails encrypted in transit between those email servers as well. Well, this is all what Start TLS is about. TLS is a type of in-transit encryption protocol. So it's not just SSL. It says, hey, transport layer security, I'm going to negotiate this encryption with my communication partner, and then I'm going to send my good stuff over that encrypted channel. So it's a way to have email systems be able to talk dynamically to every encryption or every email sending and receiving partner that it might possibly conceivably talk to and say, hey, I'd like to send you email over an encrypted channel. Are you able to talk to me on an encrypted channel? And so Start TLS is incredibly important. Most organizations will have an SMTP relay server that's in-house. They will put a certificate on it explicitly for the provision so that that SMTP relay server can auto-negotiate through Start TLS the over the transmission channel encryption to other partner email servers all around the world. But what's been happening is that certain internet service providers have been stripping the Start TLS flag out of traffic. So if I'm an email server and you're an email server and we're trying to negotiate saying, can we talk in an encrypted channel with each other? Well, we have to negotiate that. So there first has to be this piece of saying, let's start the TLS negotiations, meaning, hey, can you talk TLS? Which version of TLS can you talk? Oh, you can talk? Great. Now I'm going to, you trust my certificate. You know who I am. You did a lookup and I looked up you. And oh yes, we've verified that our certificates are good. So now therefore, I believe that you are who you say you are and you believe that I am who I say I am. Therefore, now we can send encrypted negotiated communications with each other over a TLS tunnel. So if this, now you start to see how this is really insanely important. One of the reasons that HIPAA requires so dramatically that encrypted email is utilized is because email is an essential communication component for every organization out there, including all medical related organizations. And what is typically being contained in these emails is social security numbers, names, address, telephone numbers, treatment histories, insurance information, photographs or image files that have to do with x-rays or CT scans or anything like that. But it's a whole bunch of protected health information is what it comes down to. And do you want that to be sent across the internet in a plain text, openly readable postcard format so that every intermediary who is involved in the sending or transmitting of that piece of communication is able to grab a copy of that? Well, no, that would be insane. You don't want everyone to have a copy of that. Let's just think through this example of if you send a postcard, every U.S. Postal Service employee and their equipment, their automatic scanning equipment, because yes, they photograph every single piece of mail, they can read not only the front and back, but also all the contents of that postcard. Now, on the other hand, if you write up a letter and you put it in an envelope, the theory is that that envelope protects you to a certain degree. While all of the Postal Service employees that are involved in the transmission and sending of that letter are able to see the front and the back, they can't open the contents. Now, certainly, hacking and encryption breaking is something that is oftentimes attempted, but the sense of that is now there's been tampering with it and there are mechanisms to determine whether or not something's been tampered with. So TLS is like putting an envelope around your emails. And because emails contain so many important things, it really needs to be dynamically wrapped. And so this is just utterly, blazingly outrageous beyond all belief. And what's ultimately, it's unauthorized removal and tampering with the customer's security measures. It's just unfathomable. I wanted to tell you about this because if you happen to be operating an SMTP relay server or anything on-premise that is doing outbound SMTP, you had better use Wireshark on your email server that is sending the SMTP packets. You had better use Wireshark to totally analyze, and I mean on a regular basis, to make sure that the emails that you think are being submitted and transmitted in an encrypted fashion are actually still being transmitted in an encrypted fashion. And the only way to tell that is to actually test it. Okay, let's move on to federal workers and contractors apparently are the largest source of cyber breaches. Now, this may not necessarily be intentional, but in a lot of cases, I would say it's just based upon gross negligence. I think the most blazing example of this was the Obamacare website, and that website was just slapped up with such a pile of slipshod work that it was just outrageous. It was heavily exposed that some of the deep code or the unadvertised disclosures that were on that website, it was hidden in there. You could find it if you spent even 2 minutes looking. It's not like it was hard to find, but they didn't make it blazingly in your face. Basically, the CMS site said, "You have no expectation of privacy or security for any of your information if you utilize this website." And then couple that with the fact that it was just nothing but blazing levels of incompetence and gross negligence with regards to the complete utter lack of security that was being utilized on that website. And virtually every person that I know that has either themselves, they have either a Social Security or a Medicare account, or they have a relative or somebody that they know that has a Medicare account, even people who did not sign up for Obamacare, even people who did not try to enroll using that website, they have been breached. Every single person that I've talked to about this, and I've gotten a whole bunch of emails about this as well, their information has been breached because of the gross negligence of the way that that website was put together and the fact that it had these deep plugs into things like the Medicare database. So if somebody actually had a Medicare website account, which of course everybody over the age of what, 67 would have already had that. I mean, you're just automatically enrolled whether you like it or not. So therefore, this information was all breached. So how many hundreds of millions of Americans now have their information in the hands of the Russian hackers? Oh my goodness. And that's just like the tip of the iceberg. There are all kinds of other examples of breaches, such as people who were thought to be working for Russia, you know, spies, and laptops getting stolen, laptops that were not properly encrypted, data being stored on laptops. I mean, just some of these things just boggle your mind. You think to yourself and say, well, the whole concept of encrypting hard drives, especially on laptops, this goes back 20 years as a common sense practice. So why is the federal government and their contractors not doing that right now? And I'm not saying that it's that nobody there involved in the federal government or contractors has adequate amounts of security and encryption. But when we go through literally 3 or 4 incidences per month, every single month of the year, where some breach is happening that was totally preventable by just best practices associated with cybersecurity, then that suggests that people are just not trying. They're just really not trying to have cybersecurity, and that's just utterly frustrating. Let's move on to the implications of a recent court ruling. This is from the end of October. There was a circuit court judge in Virginia that ruled that your fingerprints are not protected by the Fifth Amendment. So the Fifth Amendment, of course, is the amendment that protects you from incriminating yourself against your will. Well, this judge seems to think that your fingerprints can be compelled, that law enforcement has the right to basically grab your finger and stick it on your iPhone to unlock it, or grab your finger and stick it on whatever in order to unlock it. And this would go, you know, to take this anywhere you want with regards to retinal scans, DNA scans, voice print scans, these sorts of things. Now this entire floodgate of items associated with biometrics, this is now fully able to be, you're now able to be compelled by law enforcement to incriminate yourself if you choose to utilize biometrics. And where I see this going is mandatory biometrics under the false doctrine of enhanced security. And I do say false doctrine because once you start mandating biometrics, or if, as long as you think that biometrics are actually improving security, I think you're just full of it. And here's why. It was less than a year ago, I think, or around a year ago, where as soon as the first iPhone came out that actually had fingerprint-based authentication, it took no more than 3 days for security researchers to come up with a very effective yet very, very inexpensive and highly repeatable method to steal someone's fingerprint, to fabricate a wearable fingerprint, and to utilize that in order to unlock their iPhone. Now, this is consistent with what I've been told flat out by all kinds of people that are involved in biometrics for a living, that basically fingerprint authentication is total bullplop. And to, you know, risk being grim, when you start utilizing biometric authentication like that, you're now incentivizing somebody to come along and chop off your finger. I mean, there's already crime in Chicago where old ladies have had their fingers chopped off Because they couldn't get off their ring that some thug wanted in a fast enough period of time. They couldn't get it off their finger, so the thug's like, well, I'll just cut off your finger. So now, do we really want to incentivize people to cut off your finger so that they can biometric scan with using your fingerprint, your iPhone so they can unlock it? No, I don't think so, and I'll tell you what else. I don't want to incentivize anybody to go grab a spoon and rip out my eyeballs either so that they can utilize that for biometric, retinal scan type of unlocks. So now that this court ruling has come out, I really think you need to reevaluate your ability to memorize passwords or your ability to your willingness to say, you know what, I'm going to remember a 8-digit PIN for my phone compared to, oh, I'm going to use the convenience of my fingerprint unlock, because you need to realize that fingerprint unlock doesn't really give you any security. It doesn't give you privacy, and it certainly doesn't give you security, because, as I said, it was within 3 days that security researchers had already proven that it was very easy to steal your fingerprint and to fabricate a fully functional, mobile, long-term usable copy of your fingerprint that could be used to, frankly, unlock anything that you had thought you had secured with your fingerprint. So, as you can probably imagine, no, I haven't fallen prey to the whole biometric authentication bullplop. I do believe strongly in two-factor authentication, so somebody's basically going to have to hack my brain and then also physically get access to some physical stuff that I have that's with me all the time, so they're going to have to hack my body, which means they're going to have to come and physically take it. And, well, that's obviously a little bit harder than if somebody was just using simple single-factor authentication. So, I'm going to wrap up the show here with a new software package that is really rather interesting. It's called Detect. That is called, it's spelled DETECT. So it's Detect. And this is a software that's written by some folks that are associated with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a privacy and security nonprofit organization. And Detect promises to be a very interesting tool. The big deal about it is that it is kind of like a forensic analysis tool that's designed by folks who are literally in the forensic analysis business. And they've made this tool with some very nice instructions to give you the ability to forensically analyze your own computer without utilizing something like Kali. And Kali, which is Kali, Kali is free and open source, but it is, wow, really complex and not something that the vast majority of IT people themselves have the intellectual capacity to be able to run properly, let alone your average everyday computer user. So I was really excited to read about Detect, that it's very accessible, very easy to use, comes with some very nice instructions. It's free, so there's really no purpose for you to like not try it out. And I will again link up. I will link this, but in case you are driving and you don't want to look up the link later on, the website is resistsurveillance.org, and you can go there and check that out. Again, it's called resistsurveillance.org. And that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and please do send me an email and inquire about things or give me some feedback on the show. I like to try and educate you on the things that you're not going to hear about on the popular media. All right, have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.